Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening. It could be any of those three things, can't it? We're back with another episode of Yes Chef, sat in the lovely Devonshire Square. It's like a giant butterfly tent with nobody butterflies in. But yeah, we're here to talk all things Indian food with Mr. Vivek Singh.
Enjoy.
How have you, how's the start of the year been for you then?
Really interesting 2018, I have to say. In relation, I think everything looks positive after that.
Okay.
It's been a good start. I can't complain, you know, given how much uncertainty there is and how much people are worried about things they shouldn't worry about and shouldn't necessarily have to worry about. It's been a good start, you know, I think, and just generally, I think people are getting bored of the uncertainty too. So they're saying, you know, they've got to live their lives and they've
got to do stuff. Normal, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When you hear the negativity every day, it kind of just becomes, yeah, that's normal now. And then we'll just
that's true.
Be
that's
happy.
True. You know, you say that. And, you know, I think about it. I was speaking to somebody in Oxford earlier on in the year and they said, this isn't good for us. You know, whatever's happening is not good. I mean, young people, you know, 10 of my most productive years of my working life are going to be compromised because of decisions that, you know, people have taken. And he's quite sort of animated and quite annoyed by it.
Mm.
And I kind of just stopped and thought back. And I said, well, that's the last 10 years of my working life, actually, in the city, has been in the middle of the worst recession known to our generation of people. It's just, you know, it's everyday thing. If you don't sit back and think about it, don't let it hold you back. In the last 10 years, through all of this stuff, we managed to open 3 or 4 restaurants. So not bad. So
not too bad, is it?
Not too bad for good.
And you've currently got a lot of fluorescent paint outside of your restaurant at the moment.
Yeah, that's right.
Looks a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a holy in the city pod that we put out. I mean, this is our fifth year running it.
Yeah.
I could, you know, 5 years ago, I would never have imagined that it would be as successful as it has been. It's just one of those things that, you know, I mean, restaurants are more than about just food and drink. I mean, there is such a great opportunity to tell stories and share and bring people new experiences in ways that, you know, you couldn't have thought a few years ago. I've been incredibly lucky. We have this amazing space outside, you know, rather sheltered from the elements. You know, and that's quite important because last year when we had the Holi in the City pod, the beast from the east paid a visit, and we still had it. So, yeah. So that, you know, it's amazing. It's this brilliant, vibrant, colorful festival celebration of colors. I'm an absolute huge fan of this festival.
Do you get involved yourself? Are you covered in paint? Or
I do that. I do that. Yeah,
it'd be bad if he didn't. We're not right, would it?
I've probably done that 4 times this year. You know,
fine. Okay,
yeah, brilliant, great fun.
Yeah, it does look it.
Yeah, no, it is. It is, you know.
So you mentioned you were in Oxford. So you opened your place in Oxford, didn't you,
last year? Yeah, about 18 months now, yeah.
So what's been the difference? Because opening in the city and opening more in the city and expanding in London's fine, but going to open in Oxford, for instance, I mean, why did you choose there?
I mean, Oxford more presented itself. I think it was more a case of Oxford choosing us and us choosing Oxford. But, I mean, many ways I can see why it appealed to us. It worked because I mean, I like to think of our restaurants as pretty world-facing restaurants. You know, people from all over the world are looking at our websites, looking at our menus, and wanting to come and visit. It's not just for Indians. It's not just for people
exactly.
in London.
Yeah.
It has this sort of, you know, slight
universal appeal.
Universal appeal about it. And I kind of think that is a commonality with Oxford in many ways. People from all over the world are looking at Oxford and, you know, coming and visiting or studying or living or whatever that might be. So there was a commonality in there. And I think it's a wonderful city, stroke town, whatever you will call it, you know, to be at. And it's got a lot of Oxford residents, you know, come and visit our restaurants here anyway. So there was that. But, I mean, I still tell you, the amount of, it's been a one hell of a learning curve. Because when you work in London and you have worked all your, you know, most of your time in this country, in London, I think you take so many things for granted. You know, the body heat, the intensity, the energy, the just.
So do you mean things slow down a little
bit?
Oh, yes. Because that's what I find a lot.
That's exactly what it is.
And it becomes almost comical in a way.
Oh, I mean, it just feels like the city's shut. You know, on a Friday morning, I might go there and think, get out of the train and walk to the restaurant and think, well, is everything all right?
It's like because a Sunday here. Yeah.
It feels like a Sunday in Westminster, I tell you.
That's crazy. Do you like that? Do you when you go there, do you go, oh, it's a different way of life, isn't it? It's the feel.
It's a completely different feel. I mean, you know, whether you like it and, you know, depending on what hat you're wearing, I think you may like it as a business. You may not like it as much. You much rather like the energy and the, you know, the activity that one often finds themselves inundated with in London. You would want that for a business. But, it's just the reality of Oxford, and you're not looking to change that, and you shouldn't. You need to just go and embrace Oxford or 100%. Whatever that town or city might be for what it is.
Mm. You know. Now, should we get into the kind of the stories that we want to find out? We want to talk to you about what might be some of your earliest food memories from when you were a kid.
Right. So, earliest food memories. There are a few. One is this sort of never-ending cooking that was going on in our house when we were, I must have been 5 or 6 or whatever. I just have this memory of my mother constantly being at the stoves, constantly cooking. I mean, she used to cook 3, if not 4 meals a day for 5 of us. You know, each meal would have 3, 4, maybe 5 different things. And pretty much everything had to be cooked from scratch. Pretty much shopping happened every day. If she wasn't going out and buying vegetables and fish or whatever, there were people coming home and, you know, hawkers walking around selling things at your doorstep. But there was constantly buying, selling, you know, or the security guard or whatever, you know. The guard would kind of cycle to the nearest market, sort of 3 kilometers out, and bring a whole sack of potatoes and, you know, on the back of his cycle. So there was constantly cooking. There was always cooking going on. And often, you know, and this would happen on coal stoves. So this is before gas I'm talking about. And this is certainly before refrigeration in my household. You know, we got our first refrigerator in 1979. I must have been 8 years old.
Was that a big day?
It was a big thing, yeah. I mean, you know, not for my dad. He thought, oh, what's the point of just hoarding stale food for another,
you know, because, it's a good point.
Yeah.
You think about it.
You know, he would much prefer sort of, you know, fresh food being cooked every single meal. But, you know,
he wasn't doing the cooking.
Exactly. He wasn't doing the cooking. So that was, you know, that's certainly one of the earliest memories of so much cooking going on in the household.
That sounds awesome.
Wide range of recipes as well. I want that. I wish I had that at my house. Well, like 4 different meals a day. Gosh, beautiful.
Yeah.
And then, so whereabouts did you grow up?
So I was growing up in a very, very small colliery about 200 kilometers west of Calcutta, so in Bengal. So, you know, I have a very strong Bengali influence in my cooking. I spent about 13 years of my early life there in Bengal. And these were coal mines. My dad used to be a mining engineer. He used to run a colliery. So there were about 200 families, but, you know, ours was the kind of in the center of the thing. And there was a big playground in front of our house. And this is where all the events would happen, everything would happen. So, you know, every festival, every celebration, whether it was 26th of January, the Republic Day holiday, or Holi, or Diwali, or anything that happened had to happen in front of a house, and there would be 200 families, stroke people, descend upon your house. And so, you know, there was a lot of cooking and there was a lot of preparation always on. Something or the other was always on.
That sounds like chaos.
Were you allowed to help? Did your mum make you help? Potatoes and all that stuff?
And actually, no. I mean, I don't know why, but, you know, with me growing up, I mean, she had some help, very little. I mean, most of it was either, you know, was done by her. She was the one who was pulling it all, you know, kind of. And when very big events happened, you know, I think women from the neighborhood would come and they would all sit down together, sing songs, and, you know, probably fill samosas and make tons of puris and, you know, things like that. So they would, it would kind of turn into a potluck. You know, people would either bring big pots of dishes with them just as a contribution, or sit down in your house and, you know, help make lots of things. So yeah, there was a lot of community stuff going on.
That's crazy. I mean, as a kid, that just seems really normal to you. Like, everything's just like food orientated, and that's part of being involved in that community, right?
Oh, yeah, completely. You know, you think, what did people have in a remote coal mining community, probably 10 kilometers from the nearest market, you know, perhaps 6-7 kilometers from the nearest cinema hall or whatever. I mean, this is before television, right? I'm not talking, you know, mainstream television hadn't quite made its...
Before fridges,
right? So, you know, you think about entertainment or, you know, what do you do? What do people do? And food was a great way of, you know, bringing people together. It was just such a mainstream activity that kind of just brought people together in ways like we can only dream of these days, Kevin.
I think it'd be better. I think it'd be better. It's like whenever I go home and I sit with my little brothers and there's five little kids just staring at mobile phones. And like, if you take them away,
yeah,
like, you just play out when you were a kid, didn't you? You know, correct. And then eating was a big part because the only time you'd come in, sit down, and be made to sit at the table.
Yeah.
I've never eaten a dinner on my bloody.
But then you'd eat your food as fast as you could just so you could get back outside.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and you would eat what was put in front of you. You weren't really given options, were you? I mean, there wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, what are you having? And fast forward to now, I mean, breakfast in my household, only at the weekends, of course, but, you know, breakfast in my household now is like an a la carte menu. I'm going to have waffles. I'm going to have this. I'm going to have that. I'm going to have avocados. And, you know, it's just everybody, four people, they're all having different things. I mean, it wasn't like that when we were growing up.
No.
And I think much the better for it. Exactly. And you're not going to waste it. You know, everything on your plate has to be finished. Yeah.
Can you remember some particular dishes that your mum cooked that you're still kind of in your head? Kind of the smells, the tastes, the colors?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the one thing that she would cook lots of, and I can now understand why, you know, I totally get it. Every time we had visitors at short notice, and we had lots of visitors.
Come and see the fridge.
So, you know, we would, you know, she'd have cooked pretty much, you know, she'd cooked breakfast and finished off, you know, had a shower, whatever, cooked her lunch. My dad would have come, had his lunch, and, you know, he's gone for his siesta, an hour long nap that he used to have in the afternoon before he headed off to the office again. And then the doorbell would ring, and, you know, somebody, and often there'd be people who'd been, you know, who from either his village or whatever, they've traveled 3 days to come. This is before telephones and before, you know, and they don't even bother to send you a telegram or a letter saying we're visiting. They just show up and there's three people or four people. And, you know, she's just wiped clean everything and, you know, it's done for the afternoon kind of thing. And three people have turned up. My dad would sort of very rarely be woken from his siesta. He'll come out, you know, they'll say his niceties, hellos and whatever. Pleasantries exchanged. They'd be given tea, they'd be given some sweets because that's what you do. You always carry sweets in an Indian household and you always have some savories that you just put out in front of people. And that's really low effort. That goes out. And then after 20 minutes or so, he'd just say, well, and have you guys eaten? And I said, no. And then he would just look at her and, you know, and she would go there, she'd go start all over again. She'd make puris. And puris are these sort of puffed round deep fried bread. probably simple dough, a slight bit of shortening and some plain flour or chapati flour, whatever it is, a bit of salt, a bit of carom seed or black onion seed, so slightly savory. And so these puris, they're quite quick to cook, I mean, much quicker than a chapati or a paratha, because that's a lot more labor intensive. And so she would pretty much fry mountains of puris and put it out with the whatever vegetables she'd had, and she'd, you know, manage to rustle up quickly. So puris are a mainstay of my sort of early food memory. And then she would make this amazing tomato, sweet tomato and raisin chutney, which only when I grew up, I realized it wasn't from her family. It was more something she'd picked up from her neighbors who happened to be Bengalis. So the Bengali tomato and raisin chutney is quite a thing. And as kids, we would sort of just take this sort of jammy chutney, stuff it inside the deep fried bread and run around, fist food like little else, you know.
All the way down your elbows.
So people always visiting your house, kind of the food being a major, major part of it. Your relationship with food, was it ever, I want this to be a career kind of thing, or was it just something that was just day to day?
No, it wasn't ever a career option. I just didn't have that thinking. I don't think young boys sort of growing up in the age that I was growing up, late 70s, early 80s, or throughout the 90s, I don't think in India becoming a chef was ever a serious career option. I mean, you know, now, of course, things are different. There are tons of role models. There's lots of chefs on television. Food actually rules television in terms of entertainment. More kids. I know more kids growing up in India now that watch the Australian MasterChef than anything else. And, you know, so it's a different world we live in now. But it wasn't like that when we were growing up. So it never was a career option. But I can't even say hand on heart that I used to cook a lot or used to help my mom, because again, you know, we never had the opportunity. She never had the expectation. It was just not the normal thing to do. So, you know, boys did boys being boys, they did what boys do, run around, you know, play football, cricket, whatever, you know, go to places you shouldn't go on a cycle, you know, just whatever. But we never really got stuck into the kitchen. We never really, it wasn't expected. We weren't doing it. And there weren't many role models. But the one thing I can say is that I was always a pretty enthusiastic consumer. So, you know,
that's
that's a great way of putting it. Yeah. I think
that
are.
Is the best way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Greedy bugger.
Yeah, absolutely. One hell of a greedy bugger. So, you know, I would do anything for a good meal, for a, you know, sort of meal out or whatever. So, you know, one of the things that I always say, and I remember very vividly, was it was a small community, 200 people, whatever. But in the wedding season, that often you'd find yourself with more invitations than you could attend. And often my dad would say, well, no, look, you know, I'm traveling on work, or I have this meeting and I can't do this wedding or whatever. We'll have to just send a regret or whatever. Or what he'd do is he'd sort of, you know, he'd send a money order. So to the, you know, to the family, and saying, well, with best wishes from the Singhs, you know, it's a 5 rupee, whatever, you know, money order that would go out. And so often I'd find, you know, if he wasn't going somewhere, he couldn't make it, or he wasn't, you know, or my mother had to attend something else. And so if it was a local wedding, I'd often say to them, no, don't worry, you know, just give me the envelope, I'll go. You know, I'll go and attend. Yeah, I'll go. And so, you know, amazing. I mean, because Indian weddings are massive. They always have been. I mean, all you have to do is you have to just rock up. There's about 1,000 people being fed in some sort of a marquee or a tent somewhere, just makeshift. But earlier on in Bengal, I mean, the Bengalis are absolutely mad when it comes to hospitality and feeding people. Literally force feed. If you stop to yawn in the middle of a meal, they just put a dozen rasagollas in your mouth, you know. But I mean, it's very counterintuitive. You know, when you invite sort of 1,200 people and you're kind of paying for the food, and what do you want? You want people to just eat well, but you're not really force feeding people. That doesn't happen in Bengal. So, you know, if they need to mark you. So people mark people, you know, so the hosts will mark people. This is important. This one is the groom's brother-in-law, or the groom's father, or this, that, and the other. So people will have a hierarchy of guests. And, you know, often if you happen to be important enough or whatever, or close enough to the to the inner circle, you'll get marked. And then they will be feeding you like there is no tomorrow. Oh, that's amazing. One of my favorite things to eat is a prawn Malay curry, king prawns in a coconut and cardamom curry. I have it on the menu here, I think. And in, you know, I have it in on various sort of menus from time to time, but I never keep it on the menu all the time because, you know. But it's one of my earliest childhood memories, going to a Bengali wedding and having prawns for the first time. It just stayed with me. It's never forgotten it.
I want to go to an Indian wedding because it's the opposite to English weddings.
Should we go?
You know, it's the opposite. I went to a wedding last year and it was just, they were obviously, you know, it's an expensive job getting married in this country, I think, and in London, just outside London. They didn't feed me all day. That's why English people just get so drunk at weddings. Because they get there, they get given, you know, cheese on a stick, and then you have 6 pints, and then it's like, when do we get fed? And I sat next to, no offence, Kieran, because Kieran's a vegetarian. Sat next to our producer's a veggie. Sat next to a vegetarian, and I'd there, and I'd had this pulled pork and all that. It was all right. And then the poor bugger got brought a pita bread in tinfoil with some vegetables and a bit of feta in it. Right, if my mate listens to this, he's going to kill me.
Almost an apology, yeah.
He's going to kill me, my mate. I'm sorry, pal. I'm sorry. But the veggie moaned. But it's one of those things where English things are always so drunk, aren't they? Because there's nothing to eat. You know what I mean? I mean, you'd be fed proper.
True.
Very true. So you've always had a strong interest in food.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because of, you know, maybe surrounded by great people and it's all fun. But what do you think sparked the kind of interest into wanting to become a chef?
Growing up in the eastern part of the country, and then going to so finished school in another eastern part of the country, small towns, not a lot of opportunity, not a lot of exposure. So the obvious career choices were the same as everybody else. You know, either you got into engineering if you were really competitive and really good academically, or medicine, or if you didn't do either of those things, then you got into defense. And if you weren't good enough or sporty enough or strong enough or whatever, then you were looking for other things. And, you know, I just happened to pretty much sort of sleepwalk into a hotel school because I didn't clear any of those other things. You know, I came across somebody who just got into hotel school, and they were really gung-ho. They were, you know, they were just, they seemed like they were having a great time in college. So I asked them what it was about, what did they do? And so the way this is my sister's friend, she wrote me a 6-page letter, and, you know, the way she described it, it sounded like a 3-year-long picnic because, you know, there were no notes to make, no classes, no exams to take. It
you
seemed
were just
like
there for the prawns again.
I was just fantastic. Sound like a great opportunity. Then said they'd been to an industrial exposure in a 5-star hotel and happened to end up in a kitchen, and they were so kind of, you know, they were just having whole papayas all the time and, you know, lots of mangoes, and it sounded like the place to be. So I kind of sleepwalked into hotel school and came out of hotel school. I don't take it that seriously, but it was the most amazing hotel job one could have found. I got picked up by the best hotel group, the best job at the time. The first day of campus interviews, I was done. There was nothing else to do. So I joined the Oberoi's and I was part of the senior kitchen training program, and I did 3 years of kitchen training, and, you know, kind of you become a chef and you get a kitchen of your own. And I don't think quite, you know, I was as passionate about food and cooking and wanting to make a difference up to that point. And it was only after I completed my training and I just chanced upon Marco Pierre White's White Heat. I got given the copy of that book for coming second, you know, on something, you know. And just reading that book changed my life. I just completely changed the way I thought of chefing and working in kitchens and the responsibility you could have if you really wanted it, you know, to actually tell your story, to tell, you know, to give so much joy, bring so much, to create so many memories for so many people if you did it right and you got it right. So I kind of decided that I didn't want to pursue the conventional career path of a hotel chef. I, you know, go on and become a glorified clerk, you know, ordering ingredients and, you know, organizing things, but never really cooking at the stove. I realized that I wanted to, you know, I wanted to cook and cook for a long time because I enjoyed it and I wanted to do more and more of that and do new things. And so, yeah, there I was. I think this was 1995. Yeah, 1996, something like that. Yeah.
So what was like that first job in a kitchen? Was that daunting? Was it terrifying? Was it super exciting?
Yeah, it was super exciting. And you know, it's I started off, my first stint in the kitchen was running the night shift for a flight service. I was, you know, 5,000 meals a day for British Airways and Gulf Air and whatever in the Oberoi flight services in Mumbai. And I did that for about 7 or 8 months on the understanding that I was moving to a 5-star hotel after that and wanting to go and run the kitchen, run an Indian kitchen there. I didn't want, you know, anything to do with all the other kitchens. And you know, life has its ways of, the more you say, I don't want to do this and I don't want to do that, it makes you do the things that you don't want to do. So because I said I always wanted to work only Indian kitchen and didn't want to do anything else with, you know, scale or volume or something, they said, look, you're going to go to the flight kitchens, you're going to do this. And on the other end of that, you will get your hotel kitchens or whatever. So I did that, went in there, and the chef asked me, well, so what kitchen do you want to work in? And I said, oh, I'm here for the Indian specialty restaurant. He says, isn't everybody?
Yeah.
You're not getting that. So, you know, he put me through all the other kitchens, you know, banqueting, Thai, rotisserie, French, coffee shop, night shifts, everything, for a year before he said, I think you've earned your stripes, you know, you can go and run your Indian kitchen. So I went in and did that. It was great fun. I mean, great excitement doing it, but also just doing something well and, you know, being acknowledged for it. I think in a lot of things that we end up doing in life, flattery has a role to play. It can be a positive thing. So because I got encouraged at the right times by the right people, or, you know, so just notice generally saying, look, you've got something, you know, you should carry on. And, you know, and so that's where I ended up.
Do you feel that now, with people coming into your kitchen, you take inspiration in that as well? So like the encouragement, the kind of young people coming in, because you started very young, you know, and you're learning, and like you're saying, looking at learning all them different cuisines. You didn't want to. You want to do the best. I think most kids, because of TV, want to do Michelin star straight away.
Exactly.
You need a graft.
Yeah, I know. You need the graft. Without the graft, without the basics, you don't get very far. And that's the thing. There aren't any shortcuts to anywhere good. You know, there aren't any shortcuts to anywhere nice either. And you just got to. So for most people who think, you know, I want to get into, you know, food or chefing because you know, I want to be on television, I think it's you got to get into a kitchen if you love food and cooking. If you don't enjoy that, don't put yourself through this because it's a journey. It isn't a one day process.
And then reading Michael Pierre White's book, what was it about that book that made you just go? Because so many people have said to us about Michael Pierre White.
Yeah.
Back in the day, in the 90s, he was the first. He was a rock star of cooking.
Oh, completely, a rock star chef. I mean, that's the word. So many people use it. I think what he did was, it was the attitude that he kind of conveyed, the passion that he conveyed through the books and his quotes, you know. For the first time, I don't think I had ever come across a viewpoint contrary to how we were brought up in hotel schools. You know, in hotel schools, the mantra is, the guest is always right, doesn't matter what. You know, the guest is always right.
And he didn't say that, did he?
No. What he said was something along the lines of, if I came to your house an hour late for dinner and then criticize your wife's haircut, you know, how would you feel?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that rang a bell somewhere. And this is like, you know, 3 courses in 45 minutes, you know, what do you think I do? Fucking pull rabbits out of a hat? You know, I think those were the things, you know, quite, as a young chef, you would experience, and you would experience, you think, you know, you want to do it nicely. You want to do things nice. You're trying to do the best you can, but I think it's a two-way process. Sometimes if your guests or your customers aren't quite getting that and they want everything like that, it's just, it doesn't work. It doesn't allow you the space to do something well. And I think I could sense that, and that frustration probably, that is his aggro from there, really resonated.
Brilliant. Have you met him since and told him?
No.
Never met him?
No, I'm not. We are Facebook friends. I've never met him in person. I've never met Marco in person. And a lot of people say to me, it's actually, you know, quite all right, because very often you shouldn't meet your idols like that. It's probably just leave it. This is the way it's meant to be. Yeah. But one day, you know, who knows? I mean, he's got a restaurant right behind us, actually.
Well, let's bring him out.
So then tonight, Vivek, Marco. Imagine that. I would actually kick the door down.
So when did you find the confidence in your own cooking? Was there something that kind of presents itself? You're like, yes, this is it.
When did I find the confidence in my own cooking? I've told you about, you know, how badly I wanted to cook Indian food and, you know, at a very high level and run restaurants of my own and some Indian restaurant in 5-star hotels. And I think I kind of went around in circles. About 4 or 5 years it took me to actually get to the kitchen I really liked and worked in. But in less than 2 years, I was bored because, you know, I just thought, well, this is great, but you can't carry on cooking the 200 recipes that were decreed 500 years ago by somebody and just carry on doing the same thing, because there wasn't enough innovation or experimentation or pushing boundaries, certainly not in the environment that I was cooking at. So I thought there's so much more that could have been done. And why weren't people thinking of it? And why weren't more people doing it? And so I could sense an opportunity and I wanted to do it, but, you know, a couple of years on, I was getting really restless and bored. And I think that the hotel group at the time thought that maybe I was just sort of, you know, I was probably getting restless. So they thought probably a change of scenery would be nice. So I was moved to a really nice hotel in Jaipur. It was it was the best hotel in India at the time to work at. It was way ahead of its time, a boutique luxury hotel, 72 rooms only. It was Statler's best hotel in the world in 2000. It was just the amazing setting. But I went there and we had access to the most brilliant produce from anywhere in the world, you know, you could have had. None of this fancy, really good quality produce was being used in the Indian kitchens, because it was always, you know, oh, Indian food is just about curry, is it not? You know, why bother? And I'd say, well, you know, we have this access, and we found that, you know, almost 80% of the guests who were coming in were having and ordering Indian food, but we weren't using the best ingredients, we weren't using anything, you know, kind of, you know, any innovation, any creativity. So I said, well, look, this is an opportunity to do something new. The usual response was that, oh, look, you know, we're in the business of running hotels, not really reinventing Indian cuisine. So no, we love you, we like you, but, you know, it's not needed. And so, yeah, that was that. And then, you know, I had the opportunity to open the Cinnamon Club in London, which was a blank canvas. It was a brilliant opportunity. You could do anything you wanted.
So you actually didn't have the opportunity to cook with the produce that you had access to in that hotel.
Correct.
And that must be so frustrating.
Correct. So there you go. That's how the idea of Cinnamon Club came about. So great produce, you know, good spicing and Indian techniques and whatever else, and then really good quality produce. And with that, Cinnamon Club was born in 2001.
So why the move? So it's a massive move from there to London.
Yeah.
So how did that come about? If you like, was it through a friend?
I met some people who were attending a wedding in Rajulas in Jaipur, and they had a great time, and, you know, they were kind of completely sort of taken aback by that. And they had a friend who was, you know, looking to open a restaurant, and, you know, so one thing led to another, and it so happened that my landlord, current landlord at the Cinnamon Club, he had been on a holiday in Rajvilas the same year
to
before
we
opened. Yeah, to the hotel. He'd stayed there, he'd had a great time. So one thing led to another. It was just meant to be. It was serendipity at its best. You know.
So were you not like cooking those dishes that you wanted to cook on the side? Just taste this.
Not quite, no. But, you know, he'd had such a great time out there. He had really fond memories. And so when it came up in a conversation that, you know, I was coming from Rajulas, that's the thing. That's the restaurant we must have. So, yeah. And there we are. So just by kind of allowing ourselves the elbow room to look beyond authentic and not just be restricted by what, you know, someone had decreed 200 years ago, just by kind of creating a bit more elbow room, and giving ourselves the freedom to try something new and innovate, it was a beautiful thing that was born.
Seems like you search for that creativity throughout the career. Do you know what I mean? So like every opportunity you've had, it's like, well, I want to do more. I want to do more. Mm. When you got your first place, was it everything you thought? Do you know what I mean? Am I allowed that creativity?
Yeah, correct. You know, it was an opportunity to express in a way that probably I hadn't had before that. Because, you know, Cinema Club was conceived to be an Indian restaurant that would change people's perception of Indian food in this country. And not because, Indian restaurants weren't loved before that. You know, there was a phenomenal appetite, affection for Indian food, in this country, and has been for several years. So it wasn't like Cinema Club was, trying to get something that wasn't existing. It was just an opportunity to kind of change, because, it was also about making a statement of challenging the status quo. You know, the expectation that people had from an Indian restaurant probably pre-Cinnamon Club was that, it would be sitar music playing, dark, dingy, flock wallpaper and menus that never changed and they had to have 110, dishes on them and things like that. And the Cinema Club was about challenging all of those preconceived notions of Indian food and Indian dining in this country. I mean, there wasn't an Indian dining culture per se. It was, eating out, going out for a curry or what you will. But, it never really was taken as seriously as it is now. And now, you look at the journey that Indian food has come in this country. It's just phenomenal to see that, good ingredients, seasonal cooking, freshness of spices, smaller menus that actually tell the story, more regional expression. These are things that we now take for granted. It didn't exist in 2001 or before that. It really didn't. I think, somewhere down the line, people were I think there was a mantra that, that if it ain't broken, let's not fix it. It's just fine, let's not push the boundaries. And I think we challenge that, and I think much better for it now.
Amazing. Because I don't think many people realized there was other regions that are different cuisines, different regions.
Other than Punjabi and Bengali or, whatever that, Yeah, you're right.
Just tell my dad. My dad's the exact same every time. He's been getting the same curry since 1984. It's the same thing every
People
time.
People do that, don't
it
they?
It does, yeah. It's like when you go to any place, you have your set one and you just don't want to take the risk.
Yeah.
I don't want to have another 2 inch.
You don't want to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah. But from a chef's point of view, I mean, you think everybody has that. Everybody. There is comfort in familiarity and there's no denying that. And, everybody has a favorite place, a favorite curry, a favorite dish, a favorite restaurant. I mean, I think there is a place for that. There is no denying that. However, I do feel that, if you keep the same menus, no matter how, all the same dishes, no matter how great they are, if it comes to a point where people do not even open the menu and they're just busy chatting amongst themselves and when the waiter comes up and says, I'll have a Rogan Josh, and then the guest says, well, I'll make that too, And they haven't even opened the menu. I think that there is a breakdown in communication. There is a breakdown in engagement. I think the chefs or the kitchen or whatever that is, they've stopped speaking to their customers and stopped engaging and stopped encouraging people into trying new things. Now, the only way that engagement comes back is when the waiter says, I'm really sorry, sir, but there is no Rogan Josh. Have you not looked at the menu? It's like, what do you mean you don't have Rogan Josh?
You're an Indian restaurant.
But last time I came, it was there. Yes, sir, it was last time, say 3 weeks ago, the menu's changed. What do you mean menu's changed in 3 weeks? Yes, it has changed indeed, sir. Why don't you take a look, see if you like something else? And I think it's a huge upheaval to ask people to do that if they're not used to doing that and never have been used to doing that for decades. I think it's a big inertia to overcome, but it's worth it.
And when you did open in 2001, mm-hmm. there was definitely still that.
Oh yeah.
Was it hard for the first year to do that, or was people just coming and like trying and opening their eyes?
No, I think people came in, but came in to try because this was something new and this was something that they hadn't experienced before. But I think it did still come with a lot of baggage. People would say, well, we British don't really expect much from Indian food. Why are you trying so hard? Why is this fuss? What is this fuss about? So you think, well, you know, well, and then Indian people say, well, you know, this is too expensive. This isn't, you know, this is for the Western palate or the, you know, we don't need this. Who's this food for? You know, it's not for Indians. It's not for Europeans. Who is it for? And you think, oh, well, you know, well, you're here now, so you may as well just try it. You don't like it, you won't come back, and that's fine by us. But, you know, so the fact that we just stayed put and, you know, get up, you know, kept our head down and carried on. Eventually, I think it's always a numbers game. If more people are have a positive experience and decide to come back or advocate your product, then you'll have a viable business. And if more people go away unhappy and, you know, whatever, disappointed, then you don't have a business.
You've got to, you've also not stubborn is not the word, but you've got to do what you wanted to do.
Correct. You know? If you don't do that, you have no
customer every time. It's going to be like, you know, you do three different regions, two different courses every, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you've got to be stubborn and stick to your guns. Sometimes.
Absolutely. You have to, you have to. The conviction is almost as important as anything else in this case. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you decided to open another restaurant.
Yeah, that's right.
So how was that? Because it's insane to open a restaurant. It's so busy, right? Especially where your restaurants are.
Yeah.
So how did this opportunity come about to?
So yeah, we weren't on a whirlwind expansion program or anything like that. I mean, it was all very organic and very sort of, you know, self-funded. And so when we opened this in 2008, we already had Cinema Club going for 7 years. So, you know, we took our time, obviously. I think it must have been 2006 or something. I happened to find myself, I don't know how, but I ended up answering the phone and at reception. And there was, on the other end was a lady who said, well, you know, do you have a dress code? I mean, do you welcome children? No. Is this a club? Do I need to be a member? All kinds of things. And I didn't even know. I didn't even know at the point whether I had a view on whether people should come in jeans or not. No, I didn't have a view. I just wanted anybody and everybody to come. At the time, we were spending about £50,000 a year on PR. And, you know, we were serving about 60,000 people a year, which was a great number. But we still had capacity. We wanted to grow the business more. And I was thinking, well, who's putting up all these barriers? And, you know, what's going on here? So I thought about it, and I think the clue was in the name. I mean, it was the Cinnamon Club. It was in the old Westminster Library. It is the kind of place that people expect to actually have to wear a tie or, you know, have a dress code and no kids, no pets and what have you. So we thought, no, look, we want to do this and we want to take this cuisine to a much wider audience. And therefore, the idea of Cinnamon Kitchen was born. Because it, you know, by just the term kitchen itself is a lot more about sharing. It's a lot more about interaction, about theater, about, you know, just
family,
breaking down barriers.
As well,
correct.
You were saying, but
exactly,
think of your nana, think of your mom, think of cooking in the kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it does break down barriers in much more effective. And that's how Cinnamon Kitchen was born. And you know, this site came up, which it's very fortunate because and this used to be the old spice warehouses of the East India Company. So what a great fitting location. Amazing, you know.
It's all gone all right. It's all fallen into place, hasn't it? I need a weekend with it. It's like, you know what I mean? It's all fallen into place. Lovely. But sometimes it happens like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes the real things, you make mistakes, you do that. But fate kind of carries you through sometimes as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Nice.
So let's get into... some of the initiatives you have for your whole team. You do a lot of apprenticeship schemes.
That's
and you
right.
try to really instill that education side of it, which is, you know, obviously an important thing. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about some of those?
See, part of the reason why we went from one restaurant to two or three, whatever, was because we wanted there to be enough opportunities for people to grow, people that had stayed. I've been incredibly fortunate. I mean, an average chef stays about 7 to 8 years with me. All my head chefs are homegrown. They're all, so they've been with me 15, 17, 12 years, you know. So we have this ethos where we always look within first in terms of if you have an opportunity to grow the company, we'll always look, see if you have somebody, they want it, whatever. So the growth is as much as it is a business growth, it is also about creating opportunities and platforms for people to be able to grow into. So that's one important aspect. The other important aspect is that even if I didn't think I needed it, or, you know, I'm happy with what I'm doing, this is a great restaurant, it's a great business, it pays the bills, and, you know, I may not want it, but there might be other people who may have ambitions. And, you know, if I don't acknowledge that and I don't create enough opportunities for it, then obviously people are right in, you know, moving on and looking for other opportunities. So that's the other thing. And then, you know, as things evolve, we realize that, you know, there is a role for us all to play in terms of we get to a point where we get to by doing one person's job. You know, I know really well how to cook on a tandoor, and I can make breads like no one else can, and it's amazing. But beyond the point, to go further, we need the skills to be able to teach. And how do you teach if you have no one new in your kitchen? So, you know, there you need younger people to be coming in. And I mean, it's not the easiest lifestyle, but although I've seen the whole career kind of come a long way since the time we started. We realized quite earlier on that, you know, it wasn't enough to say to people, oh, in my time you used to work, you know, from 7 in the morning to 1 in the morning, whatever, 6 days a week, we never had a break, and da, da, da. It's fine for you, chef, but that's not what I'm wired to do. I'm not going to do that. And I think that's fine. You know, it's just about understanding that different people have different needs and different expectations. So acknowledging that and making sure that we are open, accessible, sharing knowledge and creating opportunities for people to grow. And that needn't necessarily, we quickly realized that, you know, this kind of cooking or this kind of expression was not linked to genes, or, you know, you didn't have to be born of an Indian mother's womb to be able to cook Indian food. I could teach you if I was good enough and knew how to teach. The question then became, you know, I can cook, but can I teach? And so that kind of brought to us a different kind of opportunity. So a lot of our chefs, it's very important for them to be able to, A, want to teach and be able to teach people. So we can't say, well, you know, this Romanian guy or this whatever Czech kitsch commie is the reason why my sauce doesn't taste as good as it should, because, you know, so we learned how to teach, and along the way we kind of came up with, and we just made it up as we went along, when we wanted our younger chefs to kind of grow into sous chefs or head chefs, we realized that we had to teach them all the management side that comes with it, you know, managing your ordering, your food costs. And so we devised a sous chef training program, so 18 months. And we put all, you know, people who were interested and who have been in a mark to grow, they go on to that. So all the chef de parties become sous chefs or head chefs, and you need chef de parties. So we had a chef de party training program. But in between all of that, we also we realized about 10 years ago that, you know, skill shortage was not going to go away. There wasn't an easy fix to this, and you had to just open your doors much earlier on. And it has been a frustrating process, you know, trying to attract young apprentices and keep them motivated and keep them growing and, you know, wanting to learn and so on and so forth. But I mean, I think that the easier line to take is that, oh, you know, young people don't want to work, or, you know, there's not enough interest and so on and so forth. But I once realized that I had put about 40 people through the apprenticeship training program over a period of 4 years. And that wasn't impressive. What was impressive was that 13 of them were in full-time employment with us. And I thought, that's like a whole kitchen out of just apprentices. That was amazing. So that's really good. I mean, it's a brilliant, you know, return on the time and the effort that you put into training. I mean, at the end of the day, it does come down to the fact that if we are chefs, we have, you know, if we want other people to take on this way of life, and we are advocates of that, then we've got to make sure that we are willing to
teach them and
teach them,
and, you know, put as much effort into them as they're, because they're put into the kitchen, your correct. Business, you know, correct. What I mean, the lifestyle.
Correct. Because it's a choice that people have. And, you know, we are faced with a lot of people, young people, or all people, I think, are faced with so much more choice than people our generation had. So if we really want this way of life to be preserved, i.e., you know, people be able to go to restaurants and have a good meal and celebrate a good occasion, it's just, you know, money can't buy experiences. If you want this way of life to be preserved, then, you know, we all have a responsibility.
Absolutely. And some of that kind of the negative side comes from the TV.
You know, people see
Jeopardy, you mean?
Yeah, and then you know, their expectation is something completely different to what the reality
true,
is.
True, there is the reality check there. That is.
So, I mean, how do you? Because that's quite frustrating, I suppose, from a restaurant perspective, where you've got someone coming in, they want this rock star life, and yeah. they're not prepared to work for it. But I mean, you're able to turn that round if you're able to motivate them in the right way, and
yeah. If you've got the schemes as well, I guess. If you've got these schemes in place, people know that they're going to learn. Do you know what right. I mean? If you just walk into the kitchen because you need the money, which happens to most chefs.
A lot of, yeah, that happens a lot, but that doesn't have to be the only way it happens. That's the whole point, right? So you're right. I mean, you know, when you have schemes like that and you have enough examples and people who've, you know, been through that journey or a part of that journey and, you know, they're really good examples for other people to follow, then, you know, it isn't just a lucky chance. Actually, you could do it. This is a program. This is how you get onto it.
I'll start tomorrow. Let's do it.
Me and Ben. So what's, because yeah, we've done nearly an hour now and I could go on for longer, but I was going to say, what's the next step for the Cinnamon Group and you? Is it more, because obviously you do more TV, you've got books, but what's the thing that kind of makes you happy of all them?
Well, you know, I think the bit that makes me happy is still cooking. You know?
The stove.
Yeah, it's the stove. It's what happens when you go and spend, you know, sort of, I still try and spend 2 days a week in the kitchens. It can be any of the kitchens. It doesn't, you know, have to be the same kitchen. There isn't a science to it. And often I find that the stuff that I end up cooking never really goes in front of the guest, but that's fine too. Because most often I find that I end up cooking either for the teams or, you know, for the chefs. And
new ideas.
New ideas and things. And, some of it may end up on the menus at some point. But, I mean, a lot of it doesn't, and it doesn't bother me. Because what we're doing with the teams and the chefs is probably almost as important as what we can, you know, do cooking a meal for a table of two that is celebrating a special occasion. So it's all the same. It doesn't matter. But, yeah, you know, 2 days a week of that, that's pretty good. You know, long may it continue. I'm not entirely sure whether, you know, the conventional route for expansion, for people to have, you know, 5 restaurants, 10 restaurants, 15, 20, 500. I'm not sure whether the world needs another 300 restaurants of a particular type. But if it's a journey that you're on and it's a story that you're telling, it can be a different region. It could be a different influence. It could be a different cooking style. And as long as you can carry on learning and expressing that in ways that makes you happy and your customers want to come back, I think, you know, it's a good place to be.
Well, it sounds like there's still lots of challenges there that you could just get stuck into.
Oh, yeah. All the time. I don't think any of us are short of challenges, business or otherwise. Not in the environment that we live in.
Wedding chef. That's what I think. Bring them prawns back. I think we should just put on the cinnamon the weddings. Anyway, I think if we do a little quick fire round with you, if that's
sure.
all right, Zach.
Right, so we're just going to ask you very simple questions and whatever comes to your mind.
Sure.
You just
try
shoot.
My best.
So what's the top 3 foods you couldn't live without?
Aha. Uh-huh. So I think one of them I've already mentioned to you, the king prawns. I just love that. I mean, couldn't live without, but I'd love that. The other favorite thing probably is the old Delhi style butter chicken. I can have it any time of the day or night. And if I had to pick a third, it's probably going to be this masala omelette on a toasted tea cake that I have make myself every time I go back home after a long day's work and not having eaten anything all day.
So, God, I love a toasted tea cake. You just reminded me of up north, the toasted tea cake.
Fill that in with a masala omelette, I tell you, mate. You know, it's just
There you go. What's your favorite food guilty pleasure?
It used to be Jammy Dodgers, you know.
That's a perfect answer. Let's leave it there, man. I mean, a Jammy Dodger. Guys, they've got worse. They've got smaller.
Yeah,
I don't care what they say.
I think there's like not enough jam in them.
They're like bloody wagon wheels in 1995. Look at them now.
What was one of your biggest kitchen disasters?
My biggest kitchen disaster has got to be... you know, very earlier on at the Cinnamon Club, I was on this mission to use as many different kinds of fish and seafood as one can find. And I think in the first 2 years, I ended up using 76 different kinds of fish and seafood. Because I you know, we never had access to any of that, you know, that variety back in India. So I wanted to use everything that was available on the British Isles in the, you know, from a fish point of view. And I ended up putting skate on the menu. I had never cooked with skate before. So I didn't know, you know, what happened if it was 3 days old and that there was a breakdown of ammonia, whatever. I checked skate at about 12, you know, midday, that lunch service. It was fine, absolutely fine. At about 1:15, somebody brought back a plate of the skate and said, look, you know, the guest is complaining, it smells of bleach, ammonia. I said, oh, that can't be possible. I checked it. Yes, it was a very strong bleach smell on it. So something might be wrong. I'll do another portion. I'll do something else. And then within 5 minutes, there are about 10 or 12 portions of skate that came back. I mean, my worst lunch service ever, I tell you.
Sweating.
The gills.
Sweating.
Bleachy skate. That's a good answer. Three bits of kit you can't live without in the kitchen.
Ah, okay. Of course, I'll start with the most unusual one. Mine is a mortar and pestle. I have a small brass mortar and pestle that I just couldn't do. I'll go anywhere and, you know, I must have it with me. The second would be a knife that everybody needs. Everybody has a knife that they like to use, a multi-purpose one. Pretty good. The third thing probably would be salt. I like to have salt. I mean, I can't imagine a day when... I think it's really bad omen if you run out of salt, either in your kitchen or in your home. So.
It's at home late at night, and it's just like, and then you think about it. It's like when you have eggs or something with no salt and pepper on them, and you're just like, oh, can't have it.
No. You have to have three things, those three. Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah.
So I think I know what the answer is going to be to this one, but we'll put it to the test. If you had to eat the same meal every day, what would it be?
It is probably the tea cake and omelette. I have pretty much had it, you know, most nights.
Wow.
Most nights, yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And if you could cook one meal for anybody, who would it be?
I have done it, and I'll probably still pick that. I'd cook a Hyderabadi lamb biryani for my mum, you know. You know, you would have gathered for a lot of the things that I say and a lot of the influences that I have on my food, my mum's cooking. And a lot of it, most of it, I have to say, a good part of it went completely unacknowledged and never, and, you know, totally thankless. Because for years, people would ask me, how did you get into food? And I'd kind of very cruelly, you know, sort of just to get a good laugh, cheap laugh, I'd say, oh, because my mum was a terrible cook. And that's so, so not true. She was here once, and I cooked a biryani for her, and I'd forgotten everything about it. So one day when she was back, we were all going around asking, what's the best thing you've eaten? What's the best thing you've eaten? And so we asked her, what's the best thing you've ever eaten in your life? And she thought about it, and she was very quiet. She said, 5 or 10 minutes. And later she said, you know what you asked? I think the best thing I've ever eaten was that lamb biryani you cooked when I was here last time around. I said, oh, really?
Wow,
that's mega.
That would have been a moment.
So yeah, that I would do anything to replicate that moment, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. You should have said, oh, wait till you try this skate.
Thank you very much, mate. Thank
My
you very
pleasure.
Much. It's brilliant.
Cheers. My pleasure. Thank you.
So that was Mr. Vivek Singh of Cinnamon Club, Cinnamon Kitchen, Cinnamon Bazaar and other cinnamon things. What a lovely guy. He even took my number and he's given recommendations for different places to go in India. So I am absolutely over the moon. Really nice to look back at his youth. Really, really nice to look back at kind of what made him tick when he was younger. And like the fact that we said when he opens his mouth and yawned, he'd get a prawn put in it, which made me giggle. And I'm absolutely starving. Thank you so much for listening to Yes Chef. We will see you next week. Love you. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.